Welcome. We're just getting started. Y'all, if you would have come up a little bit farther
away. We're not saying. We just came to see
you. See chapel. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is my first time to... This is my first time to be here at Pepperdine. My family has been here a lot. I don't know how long this has been coming, but my Uncle Rob McRae has spoken here several times. My grandfather John McRae spoke here a lot. He's a professor at Lincoln College. My dad Dave has spoken here. My grandmother Nesbro. So it's a long tradition of McRae to be here at Pepperdine. So it's been a very great day here.
Great day for freshman New Testament survey.
Did you? Okay, Harvey, wow, that's great. In the Church of Christ world, a lot of folks in the known in the grave, so we didn't got around. He's been out here, Liston, Harding, Wheaton, NTSU, Swanee, Hebrew, right? It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you all for spending the next 45 minutes with me. I want to start by telling you a story. In 2008, my dad and I went to a place of death in Poland. It was in December. It was cold. It was wet. And we walked under this gate that said, Arbeit macht frei, which means work makes you free. And it's Auschwitz is the name of the place, which was one of the most notorious of the Nazi death camps. Killed over a million Jewish people and others. And we walked in, we went into each of the buildings, we saw the piles of human hair that were there, shaved from the heads of the Jews that were brought there, dilapidated shoes that were just rotting, and the ownerless luggage with names still etched in, but of course their owners are gone. We saw the killing wall where you still had holes riddling the wall that pierced the bodies of the Jews there. And we ended our walkthrough in front of the ovens, which are these brick monstrosities. They were places of ash and screams. And just behind us were the gallows. And we stood there in silence looking at these ovens. And that's only one thing the whole time. And that one thing changed my life. And so as we were standing there looking at the ovens, he simply said, whatever you believe about God has to make sense right here, where it can't make sense anymore. And it was at that moment that I also remember thinking, I also remember the passage in Elie Wiesel's book, Night, which is a really powerful book about his experience in concentration camp. I think maybe even in Auschwitz. And a child was being hanged at the gallows. And Elie Wiesel was young at the time as well. And so he heard someone cry out to God, where is God? Where are you? And he said he heard someone else say, God was there on the gallows. And those two, the kind of convergence of those two things began to transform my sense of theology away from thinking that God was some being that took delight in saving us from our suffering, that was there to pluck us out of our suffering. And I began to think that perhaps God was simply in the suffering. That's where God was. God was hanging on the gallows. God was there at Auschwitz. That whatever we were going to say about God, if we could not say it truthfully at Auschwitz, we should say it. Because it has to be true there if it's going to be true anywhere. And I think this view of God being in the suffering, is very consistent with Jesus, especially one of the most formative passages for me, which is the parable of the story of the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25, which I'm sure has been influential for several years. My dad used to call that a cheat sheet for the final exam. He said, that if there is in fact a judgment day, and Jesus is saying that when you get there, here's what we're going to ask him. Here are the things that he needs to know for the final exam. Surprise, none of it had to do with what you believed, with who you said God was, who you said Jesus was, none of it. What God was going to care about at the end times, according to the story Jesus tells in Matthew, is he wants to know where you spent your time, how you spent your time, and who you spent your time with. And that if you really want to spend your time with God, you'd be in places of suffering. Because Jesus says, I'm going to be where people are hungry. I'm going to be where people are alone. I'm going to be where people are sick. I'm going to be in prison. And I began to feel that I was really uninterested in a God that doesn't get it, right? That doesn't understand what it's like to be human, to feel all those things. And I look at Jesus and think, he does get it. He gets it. He grieved. He cried. He wept. He was in prison. He was beaten. He was on death row. He was executed by the state. Like, Jesus gets it. And if he's really serious, that we want to know where he's sitting now, but he's in prison, among other places, I thought I probably should take that seriously. And so when I got back to school, back to Lipscomb, I was doing my undergrad, one of my professors, again, Richard Good, some of you may know Richard, he invited me to come out to be part of a 10-day study group that he was a part of, Riverbend Maximum Security Prison, which is the place where death row is in Tennessee. So it's a minimum and maximum security prison. And Richard said, why don't you come on out and be part of this group? And we have about six or seven outsiders, six or seven insiders. We read books together. We talk about theology. We talk about what it's like to be in prison. And we end in common prayer. And I thought, well, I don't really want to get to the judgment day and tell Jesus that I never showed up in prison since that's where he said he'd be. So I decided that I'd go out to Riverbend with Richard and the others and see what was there. And that experience of getting proximate transformed my life in a very real way. And I have found that getting proximate to people that we consider to be others is one of the three very necessary ingredients into dismantling the whole notion of enemy, or the whole notion of threat or other. That we have to get proximate, we have to shorten that distance between us and them. The people that we consider to be threats, that we consider to be other, we have to get close enough to hear the stories. And when we get close enough to hear the stories, we also have to be curious. We need proximity and curiosity. We have to be curious about what the rest of their story is. Because too often we write single stories about these people, right? Single stories are those stories that depict only one side to a person or event. And those stories are almost always, if not always, incomplete, right? There's always more to that story. And so once we get proximity, we have to be curious to hear the rest of the story. But then we also have to have humility. We need proximity, curiosity, and humility. And when I'm talking about humility, I'm not speaking about the kind that a guy at Lipscomb had when I was an RA who, when accused of being self-righteous and a know-it-all and holier than thou by his friend, said he couldn't possibly be that because humility was his greatest spiritual gift. Which was fascinating to say, since by making that gift, of course, proved it to be false. It's not that kind of humility. It's the kind of humility that I refer to as Snoopy theology. And so that is in reference to a Snoopy comic where Charlie Brown approaches Snoopy, who's on his doghouse. And Charlie Brown says, I hear you're writing a book of theology. And then he says to Snoopy, I hope you have a good title. And Snoopy says, I have the best title. And then the final frame tells us the best title of the book of theology, which is, has ever occurred to you that you might be wrong? Which I think would also be the best title for book of reconciliation as well. Has it ever occurred to us that it might be wrong? And so when I went into prison, and I went in thinking that this is what required me as a Christian, that this is where Jesus was. And I stayed, because as I got proximate and was curious and tried to maintain humility, I found lasting and beautiful relationships with people on the inside. And I stayed there for 5 years until I was banned by the prison warden for organizing on behalf of the prisoners' well-being and rights. And I've not been allowed to go back in 3 years. But those stories and those relationships transformed me. And so I went into a master's degree in Belfast and in Northern Ireland, or the North of Ireland, depending on the Protestant or Catholic. I studied conflict resolution and reconciliation. And I was doing a paper on forgiveness and reconciliation. And I began to notice that there was really nothing written about what people currently incarcerated think about forgiveness. There was nothing. There was lots of stuff about ex-political prisoners in Northern Ireland, but I found very little about what people who were in prison think about forgiveness, which both surprised me and did surprise me a little. Because, on the one hand, prisoners, generally speaking, have both received and dealt some of the worst harms that people experience in life. Right? And they're living in a system of unforgiveness. So they seem like a very relevant demographic. This conversation, I guess, but they've been left out. And that also doesn't surprise me at all, because we very successfully put prison out of sight and therefore out of mind. And therefore, when we often don't even think to go and talk to people in prison about these necessary conversations. And if we do, we often don't know how to get in. But I knew that I could get in because I was a volunteer at this prison back in Nashville. I had trust with people on the inside. And so I thought, that's really cool. I'll go back and I'll write my master's thesis about how the stories of six of the men in Riverbend, what those stories contribute to the conversation with forgiveness. Because I wanted to bring my friends' voices into the conversation had been left out of. So I came back to Nashville and did that, and I ended up a couple years later expanding that doubling of the link, which became Where the River Bends. For those who just came in, this is kind of the meat of the talk, is about this new book that I have out, and there'll be a book signing at 8:30 tonight at the Fieldhouse. I think the poster was in the bookstore. So what this book essentially does is it's three different parts. The first part is fairly academic. It may even be a little dry for some of us, but it's called an exercise in cartography. And so it's trying to create a map of the forgiveness journey. How should we think about forgiveness? How should we speak about forgiveness? What is this complex thing? And I propose a five-stranded process of a way of thinking about forgiveness. And in the second section, I tell 14 stories of prisoners. Seven men and seven women, all in Tennessee prisons. All personal interviews and conversations that I had. And I tell their stories mostly in their own words. And also talk about tell their perspectives and their thoughts on this complex notion of forgiveness. And then in the third section, I look at how those stories fit into that framework we talked about at the beginning. And then the book, of course, is bookended with a foreword by Archbishop Desmond Tutu from South Africa, and a series of five stories at the end, which are about my experiences as a volunteer chaplain. Because while I was there interviewing the men at Riverbend, the chaplain approached me and said, I think you're ready to do some volunteer chaplaincy. And I want you to do it in Unit 4, which was the mental health unit of that prison, which meant that it was the most violent unit in that prison. And of course, I wanted to know why she wanted me to go, who had no experience, to the most violent unit in prison, and she said that essentially on Unit 4, chaplaincy work looked like violence de-escalation. Because it was such a violent place, and that part of the work of faith is trying to create wholeness and well-being and health, then we had to do that work. And she knew that I had my master's in conflict resolution. She knew that I had worked with Christian peacemaker teams in the West Bank doing violence de-escalation. And so she thought that I would have something to offer. So she sent me to the high side, to the maximum security side. And what I realized soon after arriving on the maximum security side was that if the kingdom of heaven does in fact exist, then so too to the hallows of hell. And that if there is to be heaven, there's going to be hell somewhere too. And heaven, the kingdom of heaven exists in all places in this world, and so too is hell. And that place, prison is a soul-sucking place. And it was traumatizing in many ways. One of the clerks of the prison, another chaplain, told me about 2 or 3 months into it. He said, Michael, light is disappearing from your eyes. There was something about that place that was destroying me. And the chaplain herself said, beware of Unit 4. That place brutalizes souls. What I experienced there was, it's beyond anything that I can really explain even in stories, but the conditions in the maximum security prison, for the most part, are devastating. Men are generally kept in, and it's called 23-1 or 23-7, which means that they are held in solitary confinement 23 hours a day, 7 days a week. The United Nations has said that 18 days in solitary confinement is psychological torture. And I have been in Riverbend in Nashville, who've been in solitary for 12 or 13 years. These are men who commit all kinds of violence to themselves, who can try to commit violence against the officers or staff, who are fed horrific meals, who are denied all kinds of meaningful contact, denied phone calls. I knew a gentleman who had gone, I think, 7 or 8 years at that point, having never spoken on the phone with a friend or family member and never seeing someone. He had never had someone come visit him or call him in 7 or 8 years of being in solitary confinement. It reminds me of the story of the demoniac of Gerasa in the Gospels, where we hear about this man who is chained up in a cave outside of the city. The story says he's screaming in the night and cutting himself with rocks and pottery. And one of the things that I think you have to ask yourself about the story is, have the people of the city locked him, chained him in a cave outside because he is screaming in the night and cutting himself with rocks and pottery? Or is he cutting himself with rocks and pottery and screaming in the night because they've locked him in chains in a cave outside the city? Chicken or the egg, right? Which one comes first? And if that's the case, is that why they're so afraid at the end of the story when they have seen this man who they have marginalized outside of town, locked him up in a cave, and he's gone crazy, and these demons have taken over him? That when they finally see him released, they're afraid. Much the same way that white South Africans were very afraid when Nelson Mandela's government took over. Will there be some kind of retributive backlash and bloodshed, which could be expected when you have chained people in caves? And so I started wondering the same thing about the men that I met in the national security side. Were they so dangerous? Or were they in solitary confinement because they were so dangerous? Or did they become so dangerous because they were put in solitary confinement? The trauma of this place, I needed some way to process it. I needed a rhythm for dealing with this. And that for me became storytelling and prayers. I'm a storyteller, that's what I love to do. I run a monthly community storytelling night back in Nashville called 10x9. I'm developing a new program for building empathy where people do personal exchanges of stories. And I grew up in a storytelling family, and one of the things that was really formative for me was my father. I grew up in a very small town, 2,200 people, you know, two stoplights. And my dad directed the federally qualified health center there. And he used to write these stories about the traumatic experiences he had with his patients. Stories about giving ultrasound to a woman who has so many scars on her stomach. And when he inquired about them, she said it was from when her mother set her on fire when she was three. Or stories of a woman whose situation was so desperate that she felt she had no choice but to sleep with her landlord to pay the rent. Horrific stories. And he would tell these stories, and then he tried to write some sort of poem or prayers as a way to deal with this and process it, and to say, how do we speak to and of God in the midst of such suffering? In places like Auschwitz, in places like the health clinics of rural Appalachia, in places like prison. When we are in the midst of hell, how do we speak to and of that being which is supposed to be the opposite of hell? And so those story prayers inspired me to do the same approach with my experiences as a chaplain. And so at the end of this book, the appendix of this book, are five stories behind the walls about those experiences in prison, and they each end with a prayer. And in the second half of this now, or the midway point, I'm going to share two of those stories with you. The first one I won't share the prayer at the end, but the second one I will. I'll read the story and share the prayer as well. So this first story was the first one that I wrote, and it's a very explicit. It's a story that very explicitly uses the lens of incarnation, about encountering Jesus in the prison. It's called Jesus in the Outline. That Friday, I saw Jesus in the infirmary. Encountering Christ in prison was one of the primary purposes for my first visit behind the walls 4.5 years ago. I have often struggled in my life to understand how and where God works in the world, but I held tightly to Jesus' claim in Matthew 25 that he is encountered when we encounter the least of these, the hungry, the naked, the alone, the sick, the imprisoned. German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote, "Learning to see the world from below, from the perspective of those who suffer." And then when we see the world from below, we see where Jesus is hanging out. And this particular day, he was in the infirmary, and his name was David Shepherd. When Chaplain Alexander asked me to make rounds to the infirmary, I assumed he would visit one of the men with the maximum security side. Like the young man I saw the week before who had set fire to the shirt on his back just to get attention. But this time, instead, the chaplain asked me to see David. "Mr. Honey died," she said. I walked out of the chaplain's office and up the sidewalk to the infirmary, a long beige concrete building. Inside, I entered the long hall, one of two corridors housing inmates who, among other reasons, are placed on suicide watch, mental health seclusion, or have serious medical needs. The halls are cold and lifeless, except for the warm bodies inside those cells. David heard me into the hall and was standing at his window waiting for me. "Hey, Mike, thanks for stopping by. I always love seeing David. He is a warm soul, kind and compassionate, and embracing me at Boston. He's a big man, tall and stout, with long gray hair fashioned like a mullet pulled in a ponytail. His face often shows stubble, sometimes even a goatee, but this day he was clean-shaven. His laugh is deep and inviting, and he often tries to lift other spirits with encouraging words. But when I saw him that Friday, his eyes were filled with grief. After all, Mr. Honey had died. I knew Mr. Honey's health had been declining rapidly for months. His stomach had swollen to the point of seeming pregnancy and required frequent drainage. The prison's private medical provider, however, did little to assist Mr. Honey's healing or even alleviate his excruciating pain. David later told me, Honey just said he wished he had a gun so he could just end it all and he would stop hurting so bad. Mr. Honey was only 55, and he appeared to be approaching his late 60s. His failing health required constant caretaking, an activity the prison did not feel obliged to undertake. But David did. Though he had only met Mr. Honey less than a year before, he requested that Mr. Honey become his cellmate when his health began to plummet. I wondered if David realized just how serious a responsibility he had accepted. Regardless, from the moment Mr. Honey moved into David's cell in Unit 6, David rarely left his side. But now Mr. Honey had left David's, and David was under lockdown. As I stood outside the massive steel door dividing us, I wondered what to say. For a few moments, we just stood there, looking at each other, in the tile floor, as if something more powerful than us was compelling the reverent silence. Finally, I broke the quiet, saying the only appropriate thing I could think of. I'm sorry, David. How are you? He looked away and began nodding. I'm okay. My emotions are everywhere, though. I'm angry, and then I'm sad, and then I'm relieved, and then I'm angry. He looked back at me, tears brimming. I'm just real happy he's not suffering no more. David told me Mr. Honey passed peacefully in his cell, surrounded by David, the chaplain, and a couple of other friends. The months leading up to his death nearly incapacitated Mr. Honey. His pain was immense, but it was finally gone, and for that I felt grateful. David's eyes reddened as he recounted the months of constant attentiveness. Several weeks before, Mr. Honey lost his strength to walk even relatively short distances. Frequently, as I entered the compound of chaplaincy, I would see David at the front of the line in the way of the chow hall, pushing Mr. Honey in the wheelchair. Anytime Mr. Honey required moving, David's sturdy arms guided his wheelchair to the necessary destination. Back in his cell, David cooked hot meals for Mr. Honey in the microwave and fed him when he lacked sufficient strength for even such simple actions. In the last couple of weeks, Mr. Honey's lost control of nearly all his physical faculties. David told me he couldn't even go to the bathroom without help. I'd pick him up off his bunk and carry him to the toilet. He couldn't even sit up, so he leaned his head against my chest. He had internal bleeding, so there was blood on him, but I told him, don't worry, I'll clean you up in the couch. David cared for Mr. Honey like that until the end. He gave completely and unreservedly of himself to preserve whatever dignity he could for his friend. Mr. Honey died on a Saturday night, and David was placed on lockdown in the infirmary. Apparently, this is prison protocol. Because Mr. Honey died in his cell, the cell must be declared a crime scene. David was present, and so he is contained in solitary confinement pending the conclusion of the investigation. Besides the fact that the chaplain himself was also present, the prison knew that for months that Mr. Honey was dying. His death was expected, perhaps even encouraged from their apathy. Despite all this, David, the man who exhausted himself for months in selfless service to Mr. Honey, had to mourn in solitary confinement. When David finished his story, I placed my hand on the thin glass window in the door, pointing at him. I'm inspired by you, David. You have done exactly as I suspected you would. In retrospect, that statement seems obvious, since it was, in fact, Christ with whom I spoke, God in the flesh. His hair was grayer than most religious paintings depict, and his skin much lighter than the Middle Eastern Jew in the first century. Nevertheless, I talked to Jesus in prison that day. His name was David, and the prison had him under lockdown. In this next story, I'll tell you, this story is more violent. There are some graphic descriptions of the violence. There's also some profanity. I've left out some of the stronger profanity, but I haven't deleted all of it because sometimes when you're in a place that is profane, speaking profanely is the most accurate way to describe what you're experiencing. So just be aware of the violence and the profanity there. And I'm going to end with this story, and I'll read the prayer that I wrote a couple of days after I wrote the story. And if you wish, I advise you to an attitude or a posture of prayer if you want to join me in that, and we'll have some time for Q&A or for some discussion. And as I share this last story with you, the question that I guess I would like us to think about is, if we believe in incarnation, both in the life of Jesus and after the life of Jesus, and if we believe in the mystery of Matthew 25, in other words, if we believe that Jesus is in fact in prison now, what would we want his conditions to be like? You know, if our Lord is truly incarcerated, what should those prisons be like that are holding him captive? How should Jesus be caged? And so I invite you to think about that, and both how should he be caged and what should we be doing to help him if he is in fact there. So I invite you to think about that as I share this last story with you. That particular Friday began as my Fridays usually did, a quiet morning conversation with my grandmother over coffee and muffins, silent meditation, and a 30-minute drive to prison. My assignment was Unit 4, a maximum security unit where 2 of the 4 pods were designated as mental health. This unit is certainly the most violent in the prison, as the stress levels of inmates and staff stay dangerously high. Before entering, an officer warned me that the pod had been crazy all day. Acknowledging his caution, I called into the radio unit, and within seconds, the thick steel door and iron gate opened to grant me access to the pod. I shouted from the entrance that I would be around to each cell, and I started with Mr. Freeman, a man I had met just a few weeks earlier in the infirmary when he had set fire to the shirt on his back to get attention. After Mr. Freeman, I moved to the cell of Mr. Saylor, who within 2 hours would be rushed to the hospital, close to death. I greeted him cordially. "Howdy, Mr. Saylor." Having never met him before, I introduced myself. His clean face looked young, and I guess we were probably pretty close to the same age. "Are you doing okay?" asked him, smiling. Mr. Saylor tilted his head as he looked at me through the glass. Then his right hand took a small razor and quickly cut his left forearm, breaking his hand through the blood and then smeared it down his face, over his nose, mouth, and chin. One blob rested above his eye. His whole demeanor suggested that he wanted me to be intimidated, impressed, perhaps even to quiver in awe. "Is there anything I can do for you?" I asked. "Just give me a straight ticket on the road to hell." He had a lively country accent, and he swayed back and forth as he spoke. I asked him why he wanted to go to hell. "Oh, everybody wants to go to hell. It'll be fun. All that burn." The fire in his eyes intensified. He then lifted his left arm, and it was spotted with burn marks and blood from various razor cuts that day. That was quite painful, I confess. When I asked him what was wrong, he shouted at me, "Man, I am so tired. Nobody here cares about me." I looked him straight in the eyes and said as genuinely as I could, "I'm trying to care. That's why I'm saying you're talking to me." He turned around laughing and yelled, "Oh, you don't give a shit about me." He walked back to his bed, and I knew he had no reason to believe that I cared about him. When he returned to the narrow window, I told him I needed to call medical since he was bleeding. I asked an officer to make the call. The officer asked me to leave the coffin. My immediate protest did not sway me. Apologizing to Mr. Saylor, I walked down the stairs, passing 3 officers on their way up to the cell. Before I reached the floor, I heard one shout, "He's squirting! He got an artery!" The corporal shouted through the radio to me, "Get medical in here now!" And then he yelled to me to run to find latex gloves in the central staff pod. Searching frantically, I located 2 pairs and rushed back into the pod and up the stairs. Taking the gloves from me, the corporal instructed me to wait on the lower level. 4 officers gathered at his open door, and from where I stood below, I could see it all. Just as I had walked away from Mr. Saylor's door, he had sliced clean through an artery and bended his left arm. Streaks of blood now covered the whitewashed walls, as if he had squeezed a squirt bottle while turning a circle in the room. I saw him sitting calmly on his bed at the back of the cell, a laser quivering on his chest from a taser one correction officer pointed. A large gash stretched across his arm, blood streaming down his forearm onto his pants. His face, shirt, and bed were wet with blood, and he just sat there, still, smiling at the prison staff and the door. The officers in the cuffs we could cut him. So the medical team wrapped a bandage around the severed artery. By that time, he already lost so much blood that he soon collapsed unconscious. Four officers carried him down the stairs, his arms and legs stretched out and his head hanging back. I stood there, perhaps in shock, unaware of any conscious thoughts. It was as if I was in a stupor. Suddenly, I regained a sense of awareness as I heard another man calling for me. Hustling up the stairs, I moved toward his cell and peered into the window. I saw Mr. Jackson there, tattoos covering his face, anger in his eyes, and nothing in his cell. In cries of anguish, he told me what happened. Yesterday, he had lived in the cell next to Mr. Whalen, and when Mr. Whalen reached through his pipe lap and threw something into Mr. Jackson's cell, Mr. Jackson responded by throwing feces back at him. But these feces hit an officer instead. Mr. Jackson cried out to me, "I didn't mean to hit the officer. I told him over and over, I'm sorry, but they won't listen to me. I can't take it anymore." He dropped in his bed, head in his hands, body shaking in anger. My eyes scanned his cell. All his possessions had been taken in motion. Nothing remained but a coarse blanket. The logic of retribution seemed to spread itself plainly before me. Punish the wrongdoer, and when he reacts, punish him harder, and then even harder. This system takes angry, broken people and locks them in small rooms, alone, with very few possessions or constructive human contact, and then in actual wilderness where these repressed humans snap. Offering no more than 1 hour of recreation time per day in a metal cage, serving food that could repel even the most famished dogs, and taking all one's earthly possessions with each misdemeanor, our current system shames and provokes these men until they erupt. And when they do erupt, they're punished even more. Mr. Jackson couldn't take it anymore. His desperation almost broke me on the spot, and it took all I had to keep together. Numerous times while listening to him, I had asked him to pause, but I could not hear him. The pod had descended into chaos. Men were horse-kicking their doors, shouting at each other and the correction officers. Some were throwing things. I felt consumed with noise. Even with my ear pressed to the door and Mr. Jackson shouting on the other side, I could barely hear him. Inmates shouted obscenities to the correction officer shouted back, taunting the inmates to cut themselves. And they seemed very ready to oblige as shirts flew off and razors appeared. Promising Mr. Jackson that I would bring him a book to read to keep his mind occupied until the staff returned his property, I moved swiftly around the pod trying to de-escalate. I felt I had no idea what I was supposed to do. I was just making it up as I went. But one by one, the men grew quieter and their razors disappeared. I headed out of the uniform and walked back to the chaplain's office to get books for Mr. Jackson. As I walked into the crisp, cold air, the only words I could muster were those that had begun monastic prayers for centuries. O God, come to our assistance. O Lord, make haste to help us. Over and over, I repeated the mantra as I walked. Back at the chaplain's office, Chaplain Alexander was rushing out the door to catch the ambulance that was ferrying Mr. Saylor to the hospital. He was fading. She called me from the ambulance and told him that he might die. Wanting to be present with Mr. Saylor at the hospital, I rushed out of the prison and drove to where he was. After 15 minutes, my phone vibrated with an email from the chaplain telling me that I should return to the prison. When I arrived back at the chapel, the Friday night service had begun. I slipped in quietly to a pew against the side of the wall. Chaplain Alexander sat just in front of me. When she saw me sit down, she reached back and squeezed my hand, whispering Mr. Saylor was safe. Just a few minutes later, I slipped back out, crouched in a corner of the hall, and wept. I had not been prepared for what I saw that day. And I'll share with you now the prayer. O God, come to our assistance. O Lord, make haste to help us. God, where are you? How come when we call in our hours of great distress and in our moments of deepest need, you do not answer? Perhaps you too were weeping, crouched in the corner of your hallway and could not get up. Perhaps you too choked on your tears and could not raise your voice. In some ways, if I knew that were true, I think it would help. To know you also can be so shocked by our horribleness to each other that you cannot speak. to know that you also can be so traumatized by walking in hell that you must stop to weep, but give me some manner of peace. Mother and father of broken people, what we have created today, this so-called justice system, is not just. It is hell. It is darkness and flame. It consumes those who get close. It brutalizes souls. Jesus, you said that when we encounter the least of these in prison, we encounter you. And I tried to think that. But was that really you in there? Was that really you, the officers carried out of the unit to the ambulance? I did not expect you to look like that. I didn't think that you had a razor in your hand. I didn't think you would smear blood on your face while I talked with you. Had the principalities and powers really broken you so brutally that even you can't resist the demons of fury, self-hatred, and despair? I knew you would be in prison, Lord, that's why I came. But I didn't think you would be in hell. God, you are merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. Help me be the same, because I'm not. Days like that make me angry, even furious. I want to burn the prison to the ground, and someday I want all those responsible for it to burn through. Someday I want desolation. And I know who says forgive them, for they know not what they do, but sometimes I think they know. Breathe into me your spirit of loving kindness, of a justice kissed by mercy, and a truth met by peace. May I be as present as possible with each person I meet behind those and all walls, and may I always remember that whatever I do for them, I do for you. Amen. Thank you all so much for joining. We have 5 minutes. If anyone has questions or comments, pushbacks, I'd love to hear any other experiences that you've had.
I have a question. What was the racial makeup of the prison?
So most of the prisoners were, it depended on where I was. And these two stories, these were all white men that I was talking to. All white men in the South. And obviously this is Tennessee. But in different places it was very heavily black minorities. Because black people are disproportionately represented in prison. Of course, 1 in 3 black men are expected to go to prison in their lifetime. There's still overall white people make up the majority of people in prison, but proportional population is disproportionate. So I think it'd be hard to say what exactly the racial makeup was, but I would say it's slightly more white, but way more African Americans in prison.
But the great challenge for you?
Speaking to white people?
Or the race at all great challenges?
In terms of how they receive you?
It's more of a
I think it was easier for me to build. I could build trust quicker with other white men in the South. I could put on a little bit of my Southern accent from my childhood. Folks would connect to me real quick. I think there was a sense of familiarity there. But I had a pretty good relationship with many of the black men as well. But they were slower. But for the most part, they wanted you to come there because you were their ticket to get whatever they needed, right? Because they needed books, they needed you to make a phone call, they needed a chaplain. And so you could easily be deceived into thinking that people really valued you and wanted you around, when in fact, it was, you're just a tool. And so there wasn't a whole lot of room for many religious conversations, many conversations about Jesus, because you're simply trying to create an atmosphere that wasn't so violent. And a lot of men had absolutely no foundation of faith whatsoever. And I found that talking to them about faith accomplished very little. People who believed they'd been abandoned by God, didn't believe God existed, thought they deserved to be there. It was very complicated. So I was trying to find other ways to make them feel a sense of worth and value of their theology. Yeah.
You said you were in the prison for 5 years and then they banished you for 3.
Mm-hmm.
And what was all that about? Was that to help with their situation?
So, the prison at one point instituted a policy called tier management, which basically was a policy of segregating the cells within certain units. And certain pots so that when the top tier cells were open, the bottom had to be locked down. And so it was dividing the population from each other. And they had done this in prisons that were primarily, or units in prisons that were gang affiliated, so they were able to divide gangs from each other and help quell some violence. And so it made sense in that level. They thought, oh, that worked, let's just do that. It's terrible. Because not every prison functions the same. And there aren't gangs in every prison. All right, every unit in every prison. And so one place they tried to do this was in Unit 6 at Urban, which was the minimum security unit, where the trustees and the kind of the model prisoners, so to speak, are. And there had not been a single violent security incident in the history of that unit for 27 years. But they decided to segregate the population the same way. It kept people from going to their religious services, from their music sessions, from having their softball teams, or whatever else. So I organized way too many people, about 600, to try to protest the policy from the Department of Corrections. It's a bad mistake to organize that many people. You should have started smaller and let it grow organically. And one of the volunteers that I organized didn't appreciate me doing that, and so he sent my letter to the commissioner of the Department of Corrections, and then that went to the warden. The warden said I was subverting his authority, interrogated me for about 2 hours, and then banned me from prison. So, yeah, I haven't been back to that prison in 3 years. I was able to go to one women's prison for various reasons, but I've tried to get into 3 other men's prisons in Tennessee, and I've been denied every time because the official destination that they've told the people I'm trying to see is that I'm a threat to the security of the institution for that organization. Which I think, to me, what that says is that building community, advocating on behalf of prisoners, seeking out their well-being is considered a threat to the security of the institution because it's the opposite of what prisons actually want, especially private prisons. They make their profit off of people coming into their beds. They don't want people being rehabilitated and growing any kind of community. They're not doing that because they want people to go out and reoffend, because then they're going to be repeat customers and they'll make money off of those bodies. Other thoughts or questions, comments?
Do you know what the recidivism rate is?
I don't know what it is in Tennessee. I know it's close to the national average, which is between 50 and 70%. Which, of course, makes the name Department of Corrections laughable.
Yeah.
It's not good.
Anything
else? Yeah.
I personally have a problem with the moment, so I don't know about this kind of stuff, but it's pretty intense. Would you comment on some of the things that you're trying to do?